G'day, wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Treasures from the Tanakh on truth2u.org. That's truth number two, letter U.org. I'm Jono, and joining me is Torah teacher Ira Michelson. G'day, Ira.
G'day. It's are you still melting over there?
And I'm still melting. I am still melting, and I'm still waiting for rain, and it's been months since we've had decent rain.
You know, it's cold here.
That's nice. Tell me about it.
I know people in the rest of the country don't like hearing Floridians talk about us being cold when they're like having snowstorms and frost, and you know, it was like 40 degrees here last night.
Really?
Like, yeah. But that's gonna be cold.
But that's Fahrenheit, right?
That's Fahrenheit. Yeah, but still, you know, this is Florida. This is Florida. Yeah. We're not supposed to have 40 degrees.
We've had 40 degrees Celsius, and that's I don't know what's that. That's over 100, 105 maybe on the Fahrenheit. And even this morning, I had someone from the RSPCA drop in, which is sort of the animal welfare people. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to know about a paddock that was near our property, where it's not our property, and some sheep that were over there that had no shade, and they were concerned for the sheep. That's how serious it is that there are people driving around, visiting properties, going, who owns those sheep? There is no shade. They need to have shade. They need to be moved. And it's that hot. And there's as I've mentioned before recently on the program, my yard, my lawn, where the lawn used to be, it's opening up with these giant cracks, and we're in desperate need of some rain. And there was another fire, Ira. There was another fire, Ira. That's a bit of a tongue twister.
Ira.
In the northeast. And it was all blowing over our way. So it's kind of smells kind of smoky here lately, but everything's so dry, and we just want some rain. So I'll tell you what, if everyone would pray that we can have some rain, it would be a wonderful blessing if Yehovah to give us some really heavy rain.
I'll go get my headdress and go outside and
go and do that. If you think he would be impressed with that, and you think that you're not going to get struck with lightning, go ahead.
Well, two things just made me laugh about that. Number one is you know, the only place that gets really hot like that, well, there's a couple of places, like some places in Arizona, but in Las Vegas, you know, Nevada, it gets really hot. And I remember going there years ago, and it literally was like you're talking about. It was somewhere between 105 and 106 degrees during the day. And you would have to crack open. You couldn't park your car with the windows closed. You would actually have to keep the windows cracked because of the pressure. You know, in the cars from the heat, they would actually shatter windshields back then. I mean, this is going back many years. And I always amused at when people would say to me, oh, well, that's dry heat. You know, it's dry. Different. It's dry heat. And I'd say, yeah, so is my oven, but I don't hang out in that, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, it is
an improvement because Hani was recently in Sydney. And, of course, in Sydney, it's really, really humid most of the time. And so when it gets hot there, it's infinitely worse because, yes, the moment you step outside, you're lathered in sweat. But it is true, dry heat, it's a little bit easier to tolerate it, because if you can find some shade, you can kind of deal with it. You know, once you're in the shade, it's not too bad. But still, come on, 105 degrees Fahrenheit, 110, 111 it was not so long ago. It's hot regardless of the level of humidity.
Did you ever see the movie The Frisco Kid?
Western?
Gene Wilder. Yeah, it's a comedy, though. Gene Wilder plays a rabbi that comes over from Russia, you know, in the Old West. Mm-hmm. And he's making his way across the country to San Francisco, where he's supposed to be a rabbi, and he gets into all kinds of things. I mean, they steal his bags. He ends up, you know, riding cross country with a very young Harrison Ford, who has to be in his 20s when this movie was made. And
wow.
Harrison Ford plays a bank robber that's helping him get across country. Well, they get captured by Indians, and he has the Torah with him, and the Indian chief comes out of his tent. And he walks over to him and he goes, what do you call this book? And he says, Torah. And the guy's trying to Torah. And he says, the Indian chief says, I read every single word in this book. I didn't understand a word I read. And he takes him into the tent. They end up becoming friends. And there's a scene where the Indians claim that there hasn't been any rain. So they try to, they start dancing, and they're doing their rain dance and everything else. And Gene Wilder starts talking to him about his God, and he says, well, maybe you should dance for us and dance and get your God to give us rain. And he says, my God doesn't work like that. You know, you don't just get up there and dance and suddenly God's going to start giving you rain. The next thing you know, it starts thundering and lightning and the rain comes. And he goes, on the other hand.
You never know. And actually,
you never know.
That even ties into our chapters, Ira. There you go. How's that for a segue? Because we talk about the storms and how Yehovah commands the storms and the rain. And there was some talk about this weekend in the weather that, you know, we might get some. So let's hope and pray that that's the case. But in any case, look, where are we? We're in, now I'm confused right off the bat. Okay. I thought I had a grasp on what these next couple of chapters are talking about. We're talking about Job chapter 25 and Job chapter 26. 25 is so short. And 26 isn't particularly long either, but I read it in my New King James, and I thought, there's a couple of interesting things here, and I thought, hey, not bad, you know. And then I went over to my new JPS, the NJPS study Bible that I have, and now I am totally and utterly confused without hope.
I don't know if you can help me. I don't know if there's help for you.
Do you want me to tell you why?
Yes.
Well, it all kind of, I mean, you know, as if the last chapter was pretty confusing, I got to admit. Mm-hmm. The last chapter, there's a lot of stuff there to deal with. It's a little bit sort of, you can't help but have to speculate in some areas. This one, like I said, I was reading from my New King James, and I thought, hey, not bad, can deal with this. I get to my NJPS, and I'm reading in the study notes here, and it says, it begins like this, Ira. I'm not even going to start to read chapter, the passage. I'm just going to read the study notes. It says 25 verses 1 to 6, and there's only six verses in 25. It says, continuation of Job's speech. Although ascribed to Bildad, they should be assigned to Job.
What?
This is what it says, and I'm going, what? And
in
then
what?
We get to
in a new JPS.
No. Yeah, and then we get, this is in the Jewish Study Bible, which I incidentally have found this to be, you know, pretty good. This is a marvelous edition put out by Oxford, the Jewish Study Bible, and I'm pretty happy with this. But this is the first time it's kind of had me stumped. And it said, you know, see the intro, because, you know, you go to chapter 26 study notes, and it says, this is Bildad's reply. And I thought, okay, so I go to the study notes, and I read in there, and this is all they really have to say in regards to this particular area of Job. It says, here we go, a similar process of dislocation has taken place in chapter 25, where verse 1 attributes verses 2 to 6 to Bildad, while the ideas expressed can only be the words of Job. Finally, and it says, chapter 4, verse 12 to 21. Finally, in 26, 5 to 14, should be seen as Bildad's speech, which expresses ideas characteristic of Job's friends and uncharacteristic of Job. Now, what do you make of that?
I say poppycock.
I kind of think, I'm really surprised at that, I have to say, because I don't see why. I mean, when I read it first in my New King James, I thought, sure enough. In fact, you know what? There's areas, and we're going to get into it very soon, there's areas in 25 where I thought, clearly this is Bildad. Job, I don't believe that Job would say such a thing. I was happy with the way that it reads, because it begins with, then Bildad the Shuhite answered and said.
Right.
I don't know. Right. I'm going to say that the study Bible, the new JPS got it wrong.
Well, honestly, I don't know of any of the commentators that would agree with that statement in the JPS, in the new JPS. I've never heard that before. And I think that when we go through this, that I can easily show how it's wrong. But that's just what I think. It doesn't mean anything. I think it's wrong.
We better go through it then, because I'm agreeing with you at the moment. I'm agreeing with you. This is the way that it begins. After that, we get to verse 2. Of course, dominion and fear belong to him. He makes peace in his high places. Is there any number to his armies upon whom does his light not rise?
Okay.
No problem there. It says what it says. Nothing much to question. Now, this is where it gets to be, I think, we can draw some conclusions here in verse 4. How then can man be made righteous before God, or how can he be pure who was born of a woman? Even the moon does not shine, and the stars are not pure in his sight. How much less man who is a maggot, Ira, and the son of man who is a worm? Get into it, Ira. We're talking maggots and worms. But first, verse all right, 4.
So we're, what I want you to do, my friend, is I want you to turn to Job chapter 9. Well, I mean, really, if we read verse 2 of Job chapter 9.
Truly, I know it is so. This is Job has answered and said, truly, I know it is so. But how? But how can a man be righteous before God? If one wished to contend with him, he could not answer him one time out of 1,000.
Right. So now compare that to what we just read in 4.
How then can man be righteous before God, or how can he be pure who is born of a woman?
Right. And so to me, it appears that there's a possibility here that Bildad is using Job's own words from chapter 9 against him. And why I say that is because then if you read verse 7 of chapter 9 in light of what you read in verse 5, and we compare it.
7 in chapter 9.
Chapter 9, yeah.
He commands the sun, and it does not rise. He seals off the stars. He alone spreads out the heavens and treads on the waves of the sea.
Right. And also, if you look at the verses in between where you read, if you read even the rest of the verses from verse 5 on, you know, we see some things that will appear again in chapter 26 as well, related to this. And so we see a repetition of Job's words, but I think that in these six verses that Bildad is making an argument against what Job already spoke about in 9. And so this is what I think related to this.
Okay. So if we also, incidentally, if we go to Job 15, verse 4, and these are the words of Eliphaz. Uh-huh. These are the words of Eliphaz.
I have that down as well.
yeah. It says 15:14.
Right.
It does say, what is man that he could be pure, and he who was born of a woman that he could be righteous?
Right.
But Ira, is Job saying a different thing in verse 9? I don't know that he's running along the same, that they're on the same page here, because in verse 9, he's talking about standing before the Almighty, and chapter 9, sorry, that he's standing before the Almighty and having to answer questions. Is he not saying, can a man be right as far as knowledge is concerned, rather than can a man be righteous as far as his conduct is concerned?
Well, let's look at this in light of a couple of things. Let's look at it in light of what we've seen so far. We see some of the same type of language being used, like in verse 4. We see Enosh for man, and then we see Enosh again in verse 6. And what we see is, in the first couple of verses, that it's kind of a man against God, and then we're seeing a man against the heavenly host kind of thing, that even if the moon and the stars in their majesty cannot be considered deserving to stand before God, how much less a rotting worm-infested mortal like you, Job? I had to throw that in for you. Now,
just pause there for a second.
No, wait a minute. Pause.
Because,
okay.
Because this is the... Okay, so now, here, we're talking about the purity of a being. Because like, as you say, even if the moon does not shine and the stars are not pure in his sight, where does he get that idea? Because, you know, it's not as if creation has disintegrated as far as the stars are concerned. I mean, when we read in Genesis 1:18, Yehovah states clearly that they are good. It's good. It's good stuff. I did it. Right. Like it. Done.
Right.
Where does he get off saying that the stars are not pure in his sight?
Okay. So this is where I'm going with this. Okay. If we look at his previous speeches, Bildad. He never speaks about God in this way. It's Job who continuously brings up God and God's majesty and so forth. And remember, he early on, we talked about him kind of waffling back and forth, that sometimes it almost seemed blasphemous, some of the things that he talked about in relation to God and his majesty, but that the fact that he's so lofty and so high that he doesn't have any concern for man whatsoever. So if we look at what Bildad has said in the past, it seems like he's changed his position. He's no longer acting as an abuser now. Okay, in chapter 8, verse 2, he says, "How long will you say these things? The speech of your mouth is a mighty wind." You remember that when they went back and forth, calling each other, windbags. You know, and then in his second speech in chapter 18, verse 3. He says, "Why do you treat us like beasts to be stupid in your eyes?" When all his friends are trying to bring this, you know, bring this rebuke to him.
Mm-hmm.
But yet now he suddenly becomes, and I really, when I looked at this, it kind of made me chuckle because of some of the things that all of us go through, that Bildad has suddenly become a visionary now.
Mm-hmm.
Since the typical arguments haven't worked, he now becomes what I call so heavenly minded that he's of no earthly good. Now he wants to talk about the majesty of God. You know, he wants to talk the wonders of God. And this is why I think he goes back to chapter 9 and sees what Job talks about. And this is his answer to that in these six verses. It's kind of like his last ditch attempt at kind of drawing him in.
He's scraping the bottom of the barrel, Ira. He's scraping the bottom of the barrel. And his argument is that God is you know, there he is up there, and he is, you know, he's so... the sovereignty and the glory of God in his heavens. And you, all of us, regardless of whether you're guilty or not, it doesn't matter because we're all discussing little maggot worms and we're really, really gross and we can't possibly be righteous. And where have we heard that before?
Go ahead, tell me.
All right. I'm going to tell you a little story. Can I tell you a little story?
Yes.
I'm going to tell you a little story because I got a little bored over, you know, the summer break. It's been really, really hot here, and it's not like, you know, you don't want to, I don't know. Maybe I was just, maybe I'm a troublemaker. That's what it is. I'm a troublemaker.
You definitely are a troublemaker.
I'm a troublemaker. And it so happened that there was a, you know, big hoo-ha in town, you know, lots of sort of advertising and promotion in regards to a thing called the Cowra Summer Breakout. We live in the country town of Cowra in New South Wales. And there's this, the breakout is in regards to, it's a word you hear a lot in Cowra, because not because of some, you know, terrible epidemic plague or anything like that, but because of the breakout in World War II. There was a POW camp here full of Japanese and Italian soldiers, and some interesting history there. In any case, they have decided, well, let's, you know, use that word and we'll have this Cowra summer breakout. In any case, what it is an evangelical mission, a Sunday Christian mission of you know, Christians from the big city, from Sydney, where I come from, and they come out to tell all the silly little country folk about Jesus. And, you know, because we can't possibly put two and two together, and, you know, the 13 churches that exist here in Cowra certainly aren't enough. We need people that, you know, are from the city to come out and tell us, you know, really what it's all about. And what they do is they put it on for the kids. You know, they give them lollies, they play games, they do craft, and they sing songs. And, you know, they squeeze in a bit of Sunday churchianity, and everyone, you know, becomes Christians, and the world is happy again, and they all go home, they come back next year. And I thought, this will be good fun. This sounds like fun. And after all, Ira, they said, everybody's welcome. And I thought, I'm everybody. I'm welcome. That's good. I'll go. And I said to the boys, hey, do you boys want to get in on this? This will be good, because they're gonna have some craft, they're going to do some games. This will keep you, give you something to do a little bit different. And they're also going to sort of throw at you a little bit of their theology. That'll give us an opportunity to go back and see what it says in the Bible. And they thought, oh, that's great. I said, you boys, you can be my spies. And they said, okay. So they went and put on their Israeli army t-shirts and their Israeli army caps, and off they went to be.
Wait a minute. They put them on, or you had them put them on?
They put them on.
Oh, okay. I'm just checking.
The moment you say spies, they understand that they were undercover, okay. But in any case, they off they went. And look, they did have a good time. And, you know, each day they would come back, and I said, so what do they say? And they said, well, you know, they talked about this in the New Testament, and they said this, that, and what does it say? I said, well, let's go and have a look. And it turned out to be a wonderful opportunity for my boys and I. But, in fact, for all the kids, Bridget as well, we really had some good discussion afterwards about it. But one of the things, Ira, was that they came back, my boys, and Jonah said to me, Dad, they said that no one can be righteous. No one is righteous. No one can be righteous, and that we're all really bad. Is that true? And I said, well, let's go and have a look, son. Let's look it up in the Tanakh and see what happens. And we look up in the Tanakh and we see that Noah was righteous, and Abraham was righteous, and Job was righteous, and David was righteous, and Daniel was righteous, and any number of people are referred to as righteous. And I said, this is what it says. Not only that, but this is what it says, and guess who's calling them righteous? He said, who? I said, Yehovah is calling them righteous. So what do you think? And he said, well, clearly people can be righteous. And I said, that's right. And he said, so why do they say that? Now, the interesting thing is, Ira, that afternoon, out of the blue, three of the leaders of this Kara Summer Breakout decided to drop in at my place. Like, you know, like Jehovah's Witnesses do. They don't ring. They just rock up at any given time, and they want to tell you about their theology, and that's fine, but it's a little bit odd. And I thought, you know, you've got my phone number. You can give me a call, and I can expect you. Anyhow. And so they turned up and they sat down and they're nice people. They're really nice. And I said, so what is this about? You go from door to door. And they said, oh, you know, the people who attend, we'd like to go around there and just let them, you know, just tell them about Jesus if we can. And we started a conversation there. And I'd love to go into detail with that, but I better not. But one of the things that I said to them was, listen, you know, my kid, Jonah, he came home and he said, that, you know, that you said to him that no one can be righteous. And they said, yes, that's right. We're all terrible. No one can be righteous. We're filthy people and so on and so forth. Jesus. And I said, but where do you, you know, how do you explain then that Noah can be righteous, that Abraham, that Job and Daniel and David and so on and so forth? And one said, well, how do you explain, and if I remember correctly, I do believe it was Romans chapter 3, verse 10. So I turn to Romans chapter 3, verse 10. And you know what it says?
What?
It says this. I've got it here. And it's in my New King James Study Bible. It even has a little subheading, as they do from time to time, which makes some things easy to find, but also tells you what you're supposed to think before you actually read the passage. And in this case, it says, all have sinned. And it says, what then? Are we better than they? And not at all, for we have previously charged both Jews and Greeks for that they are all under sin, as it is written. So when it says as it is written, we're talking about the Tanakh, of course. And it says this, Ira, it says, there is none righteous, no, not one. There is none who understands. There is none who seek after God. They have all turned aside. They have altogether become unprofitable. There is none who does good, no, not one, and so on and so forth. And you know where it's quoting from? It's quoting from Psalm chapter 14. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing is that, you know, Paul does something that I don't really think is fair. He starts, he quotes Psalm chapter 14, but he misses out the first verse that puts it in its context. And I turned and I started laughing and I said, oh, I looked at them. I said, you know, Paul, of course, is quoting from the Tanakh. He's quoting from the Old Testament. Do you know where he's quoting from? They said, no. And I said, well, he's quoting from Psalm 14. I looked over to my son, Jonah. I said, Jonah, what's the first verse of Psalm 14? Jonah said, and this is so beautiful, I wish I had it on tape. He said, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. That part, Paul left out. Paul didn't want to qualify who he was talking about. He wanted to apply this to absolutely everybody, whereas in Psalm 14, it is applied to the fool who says in his heart, there is no God. It goes on to say, they are corrupt. They have done abominable works. There is none who does good. Jehovah looks down upon him, and so on and so forth. The fool. Now, when we come back here,
there is none who does good, not even one.
And, you know, I remember in the Sunday Christian church, Ira, when, you know, growing up in the Sunday church, we were taught, you're maggots, you're worms, we're terrible, we're horrible, we can't do anything right, we're wicked, we're disgusting, we're filthy, and so on and so forth, we're totally corrupted. And it sounds like that to me from Bildad. He's kind of giving us that. I mean, am I misinterpreting this? He's saying, how then can a man be righteous before God, or how can he be pure who is born of a woman? Even the moon and does not shine, and the stars are not pure in his sight, much less a man who is a maggot and the son of man who is a worm.
That's exactly my point.
There it is!
You know, exactly my point is that he went from being this guy who was debating. I mean, I can deal with those people. I can deal with the people that call me, you know, windbag and tell me that, you know, I'm stupid and I don't know what I'm talking about and those kind of things. I can deal with that. But it's when the people get into this kind of thing, they suddenly become visionaries and they want to teach me about the nature of God. This is why I said that he brings that typical argument that when the typical argument doesn't work, they become so heavenly minded that they're of no earthly good. Then they start to tell you the nature of God and why you couldn't possibly be righteous in God's eyes. You know, and being the perspective guy, you know, there's a second opinion to this. And, you know, the second opinion is that Bildad is actually answering, you know, Job's desire to go to take God to court. We've seen them answer him in this way before when he's made clear. You know, we can never forget that we're still, even though we're at chapter 26, that we started off in a divine council, and this is where this whole debate has been taking place. And what he's doing is he's speaking about the fact that finite men could never understand divine justice. And then here we come to Job's answer, and this is why I think it's interesting that the new JPS says what it says, because I see just the opposite taking place. Actually, when we get into chapter 26, if we didn't know that this was attributed to Job, you would actually think that this is one of his friends actually speaking. Because before, when he talks about God in the way he has in speaking about God's majesty, it's usually in very negative terms, and we don't see negativity at all. The only negativity we see is related to the, not even to the wicked here. He talks, and we'll get into that whole idea of the serpent later on in the chapter. But you would almost think that it wasn't actually him, that it was actually one of the friends speaking. So I could see why they might think that Bildad is the one that's speaking in 26. And I think that's probably why they bring that, because it seems like a different nature, but it's actually, to me, very clear that Job is answering these six verses. That Job doesn't buy into the idea that just because God is this lofty God that's divine and sets everything in motion, that somehow he sees man as being a maggot, a worm in his sight. And I think that this is an awesome answer that he brings to show just the opposite to what this kind of these people who think they're theologically sophisticated.
And you know what? That's, and I'm going to give credit to the New King James Nielsen Study Bible notes. I'm going to read those when it comes to 26, because I love the way they paraphrase this, and they do offer a paraphrase. And before I go on to that, I'm just going to read this. It's Psalm 119, verse 172. What is righteousness, Ira? It says, "My tongue shall speak of your word, for all your commandments are righteousness."
Amen.
So, surely, if we are obedient to, if we do His commandments, we're being righteous, right?
That's what it appears to say all throughout the Tanakh.
That's what it says. Okay, so chapter 26. It says, "But Job answered and said," and I'm running with that. "But Job answered and said, how have you helped him who is without power? Let me just read through the first few verses here, and then I'll read you the paraphrase that is offered by the Nelson's New King James Study Notes. And it is from 2-4. "How have you helped him who is without power? How have you saved the arm that has no strength? How have you counseled one who has no wisdom? And how have you declared sound advice to many? To whom have you uttered words, and whose spirit came from you?" Now, this is what they offer, Ira. I don't know if you see this differently, but this is the way they see it. And I kind of like this, I got to admit. It says in the study notes here, "Rather than presenting genuine questions, these verses are probably sarcastic exclamations by Job to imply how little Bildad has helped him. To paraphrase Job, it says, quote, oh, you've been a big help to me. How encouraging that you tell me I'm nothing but a worm. Finally, my cries for help have been answered." So they feel that in sarcasm, Job is responding to Bildad to say, Oh, the man of wisdom has arrived. Thank you so much, Bildad, for opening your mouth. Now everything is better.
And they wouldn't be too wrong about that. I see it as him being offended in a way that Bildad would bring something that's so obvious that it serves no purpose whatsoever. Because we're going to see that Job, in fact, he understands how omnipotent God is. And yet he presents God in a completely different way, that just because God is omnipotent and powerful doesn't make every man a worm in his sight. And I think that's the distinction that we see between the two of them in this. What version were you reading from again?
That's from the New King James.
The New King James. So I'll just tell you what I have here. So verse 2, I have, "What help are you to him that is without power? You would deliver the arm that has no strength." And again, I'm doing a more literal. "What is your counsel that has no wisdom and plentifully declared sound knowledge?" We see that same word used in before. It actually sometimes it's translated wisdom. Again, but it also can mean resourcefulness. Mm-hmm. There. And then in verse 4, to who have you declared words, and whose spirit came out from you, which is something that you already said, obviously. Mm-hmm. There's no question that they hit it on the head for me. You know, I kind of look at it the same way. It's like, you know, why don't you tell me something I don't know?
Yeah, yes. It's, you know, like,
this is what you're going to do. You're going to waste my time now.
Yeah, thanks for playing, Bildad. Moving on is kind of what he's expressed there. Verse 5, the dead tremble, those under the waters and those inhabiting them. Sheol, now I've got Sheol capitalized, is naked before him, and destruction, Ira, I've got capitalized, has no covering. Why are they, I mean, you know, Sheol, the grave, it, I mean, maybe I can tolerate a capital there. Why is destruction capitalized?
Why is destruction capitalized?
That's what I've got in the English. It's destruction is capitalized.
Well,
is it a place? Is it a person? What are they insinuating?
You don't have you don't have an asterisk that we can look at?
I don't even have an asterisk.
You don't have an asterisk. Interesting.
It's got a study note. It says, while Sheol and destruction, that is death, or the place of the dead, were fearfully hidden concepts to Job and his contemporaries, they caused no fear and held no secrets for the all-knowing God. Okay, that's fine, but why, I want to know, why is destruction capitalized?
Yeah,
is it
I
a
think
place?
That
is it a person? What is it?
Well, I think that they're attributing a person, you know, the same way that we look in, was it last week's Torah portion? It talks about... God says that he's going to go out and bring his judgment upon the Egyptians. And mm-hmm. then when it talks about it talks about God going, it says the destroyer, and destroyer is capitalized. And mm-hmm. so people come up with this concept of a malach, an angel of destruction, or the angel of death, which, quite frankly, I don't see in those verses. And I know most of Judaism teaches that, but for me, context-wise, I could just as easily see God being the one that's the destroyer. Mm-hmm. It actually, the word means destruction. And I think that's why they do that, because they do that back and forth, destroyer, destruction, and they capitalize it to kind of bring some kind of divinity that it might be speaking about an angel of death as a separate entity. But I just don't see it.
Hmm. It reminds me of a reference that I floated on the Truth to You Facebook page. And for everyone who hasn't been there yet, go to the Truth to You Facebook page, like it, and keep up to date there. But I did mention a verse from the New Testament, from the book of Revelation, that makes reference to Hades and death.
Yeah, so you know what's interesting? I'm surprised that your English doesn't have. What does your new JPS have for verse 5? It actually says the dead.
It says the dead tremble, those under the waters and those inhabiting them.
And what does your new King James say?
That's what it says. The dead.
Oh, and the JPS also says the dead.
Oh, so the JPS in 26:5 says. The shades tremble.
The shades
tremble beneath the waters and their denizens. What's a denizen? There's a new word to add to my vocabulary.
Well,
denizens.
Denizens, they say denizens because you've never heard the expression denizens of the deep?
Nope. That's a new one for me.
Denizens are, it's really the word is inhabitants there.
Okay. Now,
it's
interestingly,
denizens, but shadis. It kind of is a poetic synonym for the dead, for metim. We actually see this in several verses. We see it in Isaiah 26:14, where it says they are dead, they can never live. Shades or Rephaim, they can never rise. Thus you've dealt with them and destroyed them and caused to perish all mention of them. So they're departed spirits, but usually they're spoken of in a way that's not always so positive. We also see it in... Psalm 88:11 says this: do you work wonders for the dead? Do the Rephaim rise to praise you? And then it's Proverbs 9:18. It says, he does not know the Rephaim are there, the depths of Sheol summon. And so it's basically what I think he's saying there, and why I brought that up, is these departed spirits, is that he's answering Bildad, and he's saying, "You said that no one can hide from God's light. So who is it that can hide from God's light arising upon him?" And Job is saying, "Let's take it further to include those who are departed in Sheol, and even those who dwell in the deep of the waters."
Fair enough. But it's interesting that now I'm just looking at the new JPS, and it says, by the way, it goes on after the shades tremble beneath the waters and their denizens, Sheol is naked before him, and Abaddon, which is also capitalized, Abaddon, has no cover, is Abaddon, is the way that they've got it there. And what I was saying before, it just reminds me of an interesting verse in Revelation 6, verse 8, which makes reference to two Greek gods, and it's capitalized in the text, in the English, and that is, of course, Thanatos, which is the Greek god of death, and Hades, which is the Greek god of the underworld. So that's a curious thing there, and I can understand in reference to those that they would be capitalized. But here we're not talking about gods of the underworld. I mean, obviously, Sheol is a destination, the grave, rather than the god of an underworld and destruction. Abaddon is not a god of death or a god of an underworld or anything like that, right? But it's in reference to, is it just another way of saying the grave?
I will tell you why. It's another way of saying it. It would actually be translated as a place of destruction. The place of destruction as it relates to the underworld. And it would be where these Rephaim that we're talking about, these departed spirits, would be. And I'll tell you why it's capitalized.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say the New Testament?
But why would it be capitalized in the JPS?
Because the JPS is based on the King James.
My word.
You didn't know that, did you? I didn't know, really?
So hang on, it's not based on the original Hebrew? I mean, obviously, the original Hebrew has no capitals. JPS, I mean, I know that.
The JPS weighs heavily from the King James. They're very similar. Because in a lot of ways, the King James, as much as I dislike it, in many places it gets the Hebrew closer than some of the other English Christian translations that we have. But it's just as easily, pulled from the King James. This is why I don't necessarily. This is why what happens is I'll look at the JPS and then translate it from the Hebrew. So Abaddon. Sure. So what happens is, because Abaddon is described as the angel of the underworld in the New Testament, that's why you have more than likely this being used as a pronoun to represent a person.
There it is.
But that's not what it says in the Hebrew.
Very curious. We'll let the listeners do a little bit of homework there and make up your own mind, come to a conclusion.
You can't just say that because it, the Hebrew is clear when it says Arum Sheol Negdo Ve'en Kesot LaAvadon. That Lamed tells you it's to Avadon, not to a person, to a place. So,
but you can capitalize
right.
Place,
but look
right.
at Psalm 88:12.
Shall your wonders be known in the dark, and your righteousness in the land of forgetfulness.
Really? That's what it says. In what version is that?
I got the land of forgetfulness. That's Psalm 88:12 in the New King James. That's what it says. What do you want? What, you want me to read it from the JPS?
No, I'd like you to read it in Hebrew.
Go on, then.
This is funny.
That's what it says.
All right, so the...
Okay, hang on. Wait. So if I go down, it says, the study note, it says, the content of these verses is the worshiping community in Jerusalem. If God allows Herman, He-Man, remember Masters
He-Man
of the
Masters of the Universe.
Yeah, if He-Man to die, then He-Man's voice will never again be heard in the temple giving praise to God. Now it goes on to say, the word translated place of destruction is also found in Job 26:6. Job 28:22, Proverbs 15:11, and Proverbs 27:20.
Yeah, and so what we read in Psalm 88:12 is Hayisofav Bakever. Kever is grave, not a place of darkness or whatever you read. Hayisofar Bakever Chasdecha Emunatecha Avodon. Right. Avodon. Is your loving kindness recounted in the grave? And your faithfulness, ba'avadon, in the place of destruction.
But it's not capitalized here in the Psalms, Ira. What are you talking about? But there's not a capital here. Why doesn't it say in the capital land of capital forgetfulness, capital F? Why not?
Wait a minute. Go to Proverbs 15:11, because you brought that up. You said that was in your notes, so let's see what it says.
There is 15:11 and 27. I'm going to look at all of these. Okay, so 15:11, it says.
It's almost word for word.
Yeah, okay, so. Oh, this is good. This is even better. Ira, this one says, this is in 15:11, it says hell with a capital H. I'm not kidding. It says hell, but it does have an asterisk. No, it has an asterisk. Okay, we'll go there in a minute. And destruction with a capital D. Okay, so if we go down to the little itsy-bitsy writing next to the asterisk, this is what it says. Or Sheol and Hebrew, Abaddon.
Right, and it's almost word for word in what we read. In this chapter, right?
Yeah.
Sheol and Avadon is exposed.
But here, instead of Sheol, they've decided to go with hell.
Well, they went with hell in Proverbs 15, huh?
Yeah, instead of Sheol and in destruction, obviously, Avadon. But it's capitalized. It's not capitalized in Psalm 88. Now, the other one is 27:20. Proverbs 27:20. I want to look at all of these because this really does make the point. 27:20 of how just a little bit of tampering with the text, a little bit of cherry picking here and there, messes with people's heads. 27:28 is what I said? 27:20. It says, it does the same. So it's exactly the same. Hell, with a little tiny asterisk, and destruction, with another asterisk, are never full, so the eyes of men are never satisfied. We go down to the little tiny itsy-bitsy writing. I get my microscope. I have a look, and it says, or Sheol and Abaddon.
Okay. Now look at Job
28:22. Hang on. Job 28:22.
And you might see some capitals here.
We might. Let's just see. We're obviously not consistent in the New King James. Destruction with a capital and death with a capital. Destruction and death. Hope them are capitalized. Say, we've heard a report about it with our ears. We go down because there's an asterisk. Is there an asterisk? 27. There's no asterisk. If I go down to the study notes, it says, it doesn't even
it
have
says,
study
it
notes.
Should
if I
say, go down see the New Testament.
Yeah, so go to the cross-reference and it says 28:14. What's 14? The deep says, no, it's not related. So, okay, so was there one
Job,
more? Was
Job
there anything
31,
else? Because 31, really? Okay, 31. Let's make this last one. 31:12. It says, capital. You reckon it's going to be capital? 31:12? Okay, this is what it says. For that would be a fire that consumes destruction, lowercase d.
Really? Okay.
Oh. That's what it's decided to go the lowercase there. There is no capital. For that one there, they decided, it doesn't suit our purposes. Let's just keep that one a lowercase and move on.
So there you have it.
There you have it. I'm just looking at the notes. There's nothing in the notes. Absolutely nothing. It's just a lowercase. You need not know. Let's move on from there. It's not important for our theology. But there's going to be a few places where we feel we want to capitalize that, and
so we did.
You know, make some sort of New Testament connection. So there it is, man. How about that?
How about it?
Moving on. I think we've made our point. Verse 8. Verse 7. He stretches out the north over empty space. He hangs the earth on nothing. Mm-hmm. Remember the pictures of Atlas? You know, that big guy with the earth on his shoulders. He's not there, apparently. He's been made up. Another Greek god. He binds up the water in his thick clouds, yet the clouds are not broken under it. He covers the face of his throne and spreads his clouds over it. He drew a circular horizon, Ira, on the face of the waters at the boundary of light and darkness. Am I to conclude from that, verse 10, that Job knew that the earth was round?
No, it's actually an interesting. Read me what yours says again.
I've got. He drew a circular horizon on the face of the waters.
Circular horizon upon the face of the waters.
Yeah,
really?
Yeah, and you know, in my mind, he looks out over the ocean and he goes, you know, I reckon that's kind of curved. I reckon that probably extends all the way around. It's maybe the Earth is round. Just kind of makes sense. I don't know. Is that what he's saying?
Well, actually, if we go back to Job chapter 22, verse 14, and actually probably verses 12 through 14, we see some similar language. Again, this is
Is not God in the heights of heaven and see the highest stars, how lofty they are? Can you say, what does God know? Can he judge through the deep darkness? Thick clouds cover him so that he cannot see, and he walks above the circle
right.
of heaven.
And actually, circuit, we talked about that in 22. Yeah, it says, V'chug Shamayim. Why I bring that up is because in the Hebrew here, we have, it actually calls, it says chok, which is statute, chok chag, you know, and it's the same root as that chug. It's a statute of circle. So in other words, it's kind of like the circuit, the same way of the circuit of heaven. It's talking about a boundary of the waters that he made a circuit, and that he's described a boundary upon the face of the waters. What I think is really interesting, just going back for a second here and tying it into 22, you know, verse 12 through 14 that we talked about, is that verse in verse 9 that you read what in verse 9?
He covers the face of his throne and spreads his clouds
over
it.
So it's talking about in verse 12 and 14, we talked about him not being seen through the clouds or through darkness or whatever. It's just an interesting connection to this verse here, because I looked at the Targum, you know, the Targum, which is kind of an Aramaic, I wouldn't say a direct translation. It's almost like Midrash in a sense. And it says this, he wraps his throne in darkness so that the angels should not be able to see him. He places a screen around himself, the clouds of glory. I love that. It is really cool the way it describes that. And I think what's being said here is that when you talk about that word north, you know, talking about, you know, spreads out the what does it say again? He stretched out the north. Stretched out the north over the empty space or over chaos. It actually says al tohu, like we say tohu vavohu, you know, formless and void. It's that same word tohu as we see in Breshit in Genesis, in the first couple of verses of Genesis, that the earth was formless and void or in chaos. That's what it's talking about. And safon, which is the word for north, sometimes could kind of be in the same way that we see kiseh, which is chair or throne. You know, that we're seeing that Safon could also be speaking about the heavens, that it kind of connects us to the heavenly realm. And so, you know, all of this that we see this this boundary that God has set up on the face of the waters that we're talking about. And I love the second part of the verse. It says, for me, as far as the extreme of light and darkness, in verse 10. Did he describe the boundary upon the face of the waters as far as the extreme of light with darkness, or until the end of light and darkness? So it's almost like we have this idea of the throne of God, you know, him hanging the earth, and this boundary that he set up is the sands of the seashore, because they act as the boundary for the water. Somehow he's done that. And light and darkness have been used throughout this book of Job to describe day and night, but also have been used poetically or metaphorically to describe joy and sorrow. So to me, in describing the God he knows, Job could be trying to give us an understanding that even when light and darkness come to an end, the boundaries that God has set up will still be imposed upon the waters.
So the thing that I really get quite excited about, Ira, going back to the beginning of our conversation, he binds up the water in his thick clouds. That's the bit that I'm really excited about at the moment. I want some of those thick clouds. I want some of those to come over and just dump everything it's got on right where we
are. About what it's saying. It's so He's saying that we would think that with the way that the clouds are filled with this kind of water, that they, you know, how do we make sense of that? They should split. You know, and they shouldn't split because of the weight of this water, and yet they come down drop by drop, that he sets a boundary even for that.
Thousands of tons floating in the sky. Can it be explained? It is incredible. We serve a mighty God.
Verse 11 is what I love. This is awesome.
The pillars of heaven tremble, is what I've got. The pillars of heaven tremble and are astonished at his rebuke.
The word that we're looking at here is tremble. Yerofafu actually means to sway or to totter, that the pillars of heaven sway or totter. and they are astonished or amazed at his rebuke. But that word also, again, when we look at that word, which is translated as amazed or astonished, the word can actually mean to freeze with fear, okay? Mm-hmm. So there's a possibility that in him talking about the earth hanging on nothingness and God setting up boundaries for the clouds and the water and so forth, that what he's doing here is he's referencing creation, that the pillars that held up this world were swaying and teetering and tottering because of chaos, but at his rebuke, they froze in fear and they were made firm. And okay. Here's opinion two. My second opinion, okay.
if you don't like that one, here's this one.
Or it could be related to the fact that there are natural events that occur that shake the pillars of the earth, and it's only in his rebuke that they are frozen, that they freeze in fear, that they're amazed and astonished, and the earth is made firm once again. But I'm going with the creation one. I like the creation one because to me it makes sense in light of him talking about Tohu and the, you know, because it seems like he's talking about the creation and how God set everything in motion. And just imagine that. The pillars of heaven sway and they freeze in fear at his rebuke. That's powerful.
That's very powerful. Well, he stirs up the sea with his power. And by his understanding, he breaks up the storm. Well, that's what I've got. He breaks up the storm. I assume that means that he kind of breaks up the clouds and water pours really? Out of them and thunder and lightning.
Is that the new King James?
I assume that's what it means. That's the new King James.
On to the JPS. What does that say?
Okay, on the JPS. Hang on a second. Let me grab it. It says in verse 12, by his power, he stilled the sea. By his skill, he struck down Rahab.
Ouch!
What's he striking down Rahab for? It's got a capital here.
Yeah. So the problem is that you're thinking of it as Rahab, the person. It's not. It's not Rahab. It's Rahab. Let's look at Isaiah 51 verse 9.
I'm just looking at the. Before I even go there.
No asterisk.
I am looking at. Well, no, it's not an asterisk, but it does have a little note here in the NJPS. It says Rahab. The personified sea is what it has. But there's a few notes there. But let's jump over to where was
Isaiah 51:9.
You know, this is the curse of being one of the curses of being brought up in the Sunday church is that when you go to the JPS, everything's out of order.
JPS 1:9.
It says, "I know it's in the right order, but it's a different order. Awake, awake! Clothe yourself with splendor, O arm of Yehovah! Awake." As in days of old, as in former ages, it was you that hacked Rahab in pieces, that pierced the dragon. Ooh, now I've got Rahab and dragon in. I've got Rahab and dragon in capitals in the new JPS. Oh man, this is just. We can't spend all this time ironing out capital letters.
All right,
I don't. Okay, I'm just going to look it up in my...
No, go to Psalm 89, 10, and 11. Well, no, 89, 10 in your English. It's 89, 11 in the Hebrew. So 89, 10.
Yeah, I got to see what it says. I just want to see if it's capitalized in the New King James. I'm looking and it says... it even says Rahab in the New King James. It says Rahab and wounded the serpent. But the serpent's not capitalized in the New King James. What's that about? That's an opportunity missed.
I knew we were going to have fun on these verses.
Come on. I mean, if there's an opportunity to, I mean, that should be, with Christian theology, that's got to be capitalized, but they haven't put it there. All right. So, or even the capitalized dragon, like the JPS, it just flows so well with Revelation. Come on, people.
Anyway, Psalm 89:10.
That's an opportunity missed. Psalm 89:10. 89. Well, we were in 88 a second ago. Now we're in 89. Verse 10, it does say, when you have broken Rahab in pieces as one who is slain, you have scattered your enemies with your mighty arm.
So we want to make sense of who Rahab is, right?
Who is she?
Not she, he.
What is it, about? It's a female
no,
name?
What are you talking about? It says you crushed Rahab. He was like a corpse.
In the study notes of the New King James, Rahab is a title for Egypt, it says here.
Ah, so now we're getting into something really interesting.
This is interesting. It goes on to say, the sea and Rahab refer to God's great victories in the beginning, his control of his creation in the historic past, his victory over Egypt, and in the future, his complete triumph over capitalist Satan and sin and death. Party on,
dude.
The psalmist. Yeah, it's just, you know, it goes on. So all right, anyway, come on, you gotta help us out here.
So Rahab really is.
Hang on a minute. No. This is no
what
fun.
What do you mean it's
no
fun?
Because I read in the JPS, in the new JPS, I read the note. What did I say there that Rahab was? What did they say? What did I read the first time? Let me just find it again. Because I've just read all these different Rahab. It says 9 to 10. Isaiah 51, 9 to 10. It says Rahab, dragon, abyss of the sea. These refer to mythical beings who God defeated to create the world. What?
Yeah, so, we'll get there. We'll get there when we get there. Take your time. Wait a second.
Well, hang on. I just want to go. I want to go back to Job and read Rahab. I just got to iron this out before you make sense of it. I just want to go through it just quickly again in my head. Rahab in verse 12, and I read before. In 26:12, it said Rahab, the personified sea. That's got the personified sea. You flip over to Isaiah, it makes mention of the dragon or someone that God had to be victorious over before he created the world. In the New King James study note, it says Egypt, but in that's the one in Psalms, right? That's the reference that I read in Psalm 89, verse 10. It's a title for Egypt. But if I go back to the study note on Isaiah 51, verse 9 in the New King James, then it says Rahab was a mythical serpent that resisted God's creation of the universe. This is just okay. I got to admit, this is a bit beyond me. I don't get it. I've never heard, together before. This is all new.
Okay, so what you're hearing is a little bit of Talmudic. What you're reading in the study notes, it's considered. I personally believe that this is just an alternate name for Leviathan. For Leviathan or Leviathan that we read in the Hebrew. What you're reading is based on the fact that there was actually a Canaanite. There was the Canaanites had a name for their sea god, which is called Prince River. And the Talmud calls Rahab Prince of the Sea, which echoes the name of that Canaanite sea god. And what the Talmud says is that God slew him when he refused to help in creating the earth. And that the lethal stink of his carcass is concealed by the oceans, which is why they smell so strange. That's what the Talmud actually says in Bava Batra 74b. But we're going to make sense of this. I'm going to tell you why I think it is, but we have to go to the next verse to do that. We have to go to the next verse and look at a couple more verses to make sense
of this. All right, let's do that.
So what does it say in verse 13?
So 26. So it says in verse 13, by his spirit he adorned the heavens so this is weird. By his spirit he adorned the heavens. His hand pierced the fleeing serpent.
Ooh, the fleeing serpent. So
lowercase s, another opportunity lost.
Another opportunity lost.
Yeah.
It says by his hand, Nachash Bariach. And we see something similar to that in Isaiah 27:1.
Isaiah 27:1. Yep. Before, so I'm going to read that in.
And by the way, what did you say? The fleeing serpent?
Yeah, the fleeing serpent.
That's not bad. It's what I have here is with his breath, the heavens are made bare. His hand has pierced the elusive serpent.
Okay, I've got in 27:1, in that day Jehovah will punish with his great, cruel, mighty sword, Leviathan, the elusive serpent. Ooh, even elusive has a capital here. The elusive
really?
Serpent, Leviathan, the twisting serpent, that's capitalized as well. Twisting serpent is capitalized, and will slay the dragon, the capitalized dragon of the sea. I tell you what, I'm just so overloaded with capitals here. That's in the JPS. Now I've got to go to the other one. I'm not satisfied with just that. If there's capitals all over the shop, I want to see. What is it again? 27:1. 27:1? All right, so I'm just going to double check because I just want to see if there's consistency here with capital letters. Here we go. It says, in that day Jehovah will, with his severe sword, great and strong, will punish Leviathan, the fleeing serpent. Now, Leviathan, of course, is capitalized, but the fleeing serpent is not. Leviathan, that twisted serpent is not capitalized, and he will slay the reptile, not capitalized, that is in the sea. Oh, boy.
Yeah, okay. And that reptile, it actually, Hatanin. Tanin mm-hmm. is the word there, which is typically translated as serpent or dragon or something like that, as opposed to mm-hmm. Nahash, which is usually, you know, a snake. We see the Nahash all through the Tanakh. You know, the copper serpent, the fiery serpents that we see in mm-hmm. you know in the wilderness, which were soft-scaled vipers. They're Nahash, or yes. the Nahash that's mm-hmm. the copper Nahash. And Nahash can also mean copper. It comes from that idea. But now so we've looked at that. Now let's look at Psalm 74:13.
You divided the sea by your strength. You broke the heads of the sea serpents in the right. water. That's all lowercase. But it goes on to say, you broke the heads of Leviathan in pieces and gave him as food yes. to the people. Inhabiting right. the wilderness. Oh, man, you're not helping me at all. You're just making it more and more confusing.
So 74:13 has the taninim, you know, like we said, tanin, you know, this idea of the serpents. But what I'm just trying to show you is that all through that we see these verses that are all similar, that are all talking about these sea serpents and these elusive serpents and everything else. It's all talking about these sea creatures. And whether they were legitimately, remember we talked about Leviathan before, you know, and we made sense of potentially what this was. Just like we talked about dinosaurs and things like that, you know, the possibility that these different type of creatures existed. We see this all through. So all I'm trying to say is that Rechav, when it's talking about Rechav and Leviathan and all this, it's talking about these specific creatures that were water creatures. It's not something mm-hmm. that should be translated with capitals that make it refer to some kind of, Christian idea of, a destroyer or destruction or Satan or any of these things that we've dealt with in the first two chapters mm-hmm. of Job. You know, it's talking about serpents of the sea. It's not talking about capital S Satan, capital S serpent, capital L Leviathan, capital S Rechav. Mm. Those are all things that are done by the translators in their bias based on this concept of an entity that stands in opposition to God, which is just nonsensical in the Hebrew.
So clearly it's obviously not literal, rather it's figurative in particularly when we're talking about, I mean, please tell me that verse 14 of 74 is metaphoric, and you broke the heads of the Leviathan in pieces and gave him as food to the people inhabiting the wilderness. He's not feeding, I mean, I don't know, unless Leviathan has fins and scales. Maybe he's got fins and scales.
Maybe he's kosher.
Well, he might have fins and scales.
But here's where it gets interesting, and I like that this was brought up by you, because some people believe that this is actually a reference to this week's Torah portion where we see the Egyptians destroyed in the waters of Yam Suf. And why do they think that? Why do they think that? They actually think that this is what that's speaking about. All of these verses.
So this is now you're telling me why Rahab is also sometimes referenced as Egypt. Yes. Is there a connection?
Yeah, because there is some belief that these verses are actually speaking about God's God bringing judgment upon Pharaoh, and what was the thing that Pharaoh wore on his headpiece?
Oh, I don't know. What did he wear on his headpiece?
Yeah, if you ever look at pictures of the pharaohs in hieroglyphics and everything.
Did Yul Brynner have a cobra on his head?
If you look at the pictures, they all have the headpiece with a cobra. That's one of the signs of the rulership of Egypt.
They did. They also had big ram's horns, too.
Did big what?
They liked to play dress-ups, didn't they?
Yeah.
They did. Sometimes they were the cobras. Sometimes they had ram horns, as if to say, Yeah.
Now I'm going to have that voice in my head for the rest of the night.
Which one's
Yul
that?
Brynner.
Yul Brynner. He's great.
So it is written, so it shall be done.
Yes.
Moses.
Hang on. Moses. That was the king and
Moses.
I, wasn't it?
Moses.
So it shall be written, so it shall be done.
The way he would say Moses. He was as distinct as
all right. Well, that
as,
helps
what's
me.
His name is Jim Kirk on Star Trek.
But the,
Spock.
Sorry, that helps me anyhow.
It does so help
that,
you?
I'm going to be able to sleep tonight with that.
That
yeah, I think I can sleep tonight.
Okay.
So the last verse. Indeed, these are the mere edges of his ways, Ira. They're just the mere edges of his ways, and how small a whisper we hear of him, but the thunder of his power, who can understand? Man, I'd like to hear some of that thunder.
Who can? So I think this is how I would sum it up, what we've looked at tonight. This is really Job's last speech in which he speaks directly or he's debating with his friends. Or answering something. I think everything that we see from this point on is just his musings. I don't think he's actually in debate anymore. They're just kind of almost seem like soliloquies from this point on when we hear Job speaking.
That's a big word. What's that again? Say that one again. Okay, so I've got that and I've got denizens. I've got a couple of new words to deal with. Soliloquy.
So as we said, you know, it's not enough that Bildad spoke as he did about God. Job is saying that he's even much more. And you know, these are just the edges of the way. But I'm not convinced. Mm-hmm. You haven't convinced me with those six verses that you brought that in all his glory that this has to make man a rotting worm in his presence. And this kind of puts Job back in a predicament that we've seen him in from the beginning, because he's saying that if there is no understanding, no discerning, this thundering that nobody can hear even a whisper of his voice, then he's left with that same restlessness, that same alienation, that same loneliness, that same thing that has been driving him to wish for death, which we've seen him do over and over again. And yet it really is what separates him from his friends, who, as we said earlier, so typically of people that you and I know and have dealt with, pass themselves off as being theologically sophisticated. Because he still maintains this aching and longing for God that they seem to have lost. In other words, they think they know God. They think they're speaking for God. They think they know God. They think, you know, Bildad just, you know, kind of brought this whole, you know, I'm going to show you how divine God is. And he's separate from them, because if what they say is true, then he's right back to where he has been all along, being afraid, being angry, being demanding, and even seeming rebellious or, you know, standing on the edge of blasphemy, which I don't think is his nature. And we can never, ever, ever forget where he's at. You know, we're reading about this guy, and we haven't brought this up, and I'm not doing this, I'm not doing this jokingly or whatever, and I'm not talking about it. But let's remember that this is a man who's in intense, deep suffering. We haven't seen him described in many weeks over the chapters, but if we remember clearly, this is a guy who's, you know, longing for death because of his physical condition. His mental condition can't be any better, you know, because of the suffering he's going through, and so we can never forget that.
Let's not think that when Bildad said how much less a man who is a maggot and the son of man who is a worm, that he wasn't looking at Job who's covered in maggots.
You brought it up, not me.
I know. But that is the reality of the situation, my friend. Thank you once again. Treasures from the Tanakh, Torah teacher Ira Michelson. The website is, what is the website
the
again?
The website is www.torahthreads.com.
Torahthreads.com. There is a Torah Threads page on Facebook, as well as a Treasures from the Tanakh page on Facebook. You can find those. TorahThreads.com is the website. My friend, thank you once again for coming back on. Next week, we're going to be in chapter 27. And until then,
we are, and we're getting close. We're getting closer.
We're getting closer. We're past the halfway mark. We're past the point of no return. And, you know, in a few chapters, we're going to have a new character, Elihu. I'm looking forward to him. But we're going to continue on with Job next week in 27. Until then, dear listeners, be blessed, be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom. Okay.
That was fun.
Wow. That was pretty good.
I knew we'd have fun with that. I knew I'd get you going with those.